This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There has been one especially persistent rumor through this presidential campaign that Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama is a Muslim, a rumor that Republican Colin Powell addressed directly as he endorsed Senator Obama on NBC's Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago.
Well, the correct answer is he is not a Muslim. He's a Christian. He's always been a Christian. But the really right answer is, what if he is? Is there something wrong with being a Muslim in this country? The answer is no, that's not America. Is there something wrong with some 7-year-old Muslim American kid believing that he or she could be president? Yet I have heard senior members of my own party drop this suggestion. He's a Muslim and he might be associated with terrorists. This is not the way we should be doing it in America.
But the former Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is among very few to make that point in public. It appears that both presidential campaigns have avoided association with Muslim Americans and Arab Americans who some regard as politically radioactive, too hot to touch. If you are a Muslim American or Arab American, how has this campaign played out for you? Give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can also share your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, we continue our series of final arguments. Today, John McWhorter argues the case for Senator Barack Obama on domestic policy. But first, joining us by phone from his district office in Minnesota is Representative Keith Ellison, the first Muslim American elected to Congress. And it's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation. We know you're busy. We appreciate your time today.
Hey, great to be back. How you doing?
Very well, thank you. And let me ask you, is it fair to say you're a supporter of the Democratic presidential candidate, Barack Obama, but do you think it's fair to say that he has kept you in particular and Muslim Americans in general at arm's length?
Well, I am a strong supporter of Barack Obama. I admire him. I think he's going to be a great president. And I don't know if it's fair to say that he has kept distance. I will say that there were points of nervousness that emanated from the campaign at certain points. Right now, I think we're doing fine. I think we've been doing fine for several months now. But there was a period of time back there before the primary was over that there were some things that, you know, there were some points that could stand to be improved, and they got better.
You came forward last December to speak on Senator Obama's behalf at a mosque in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and your offer was turned down.
Yeah, it's true.
And there's the famous...
But not by Barack Obama.
And
that a lot of that had to do with, see, here's the problem. You know, when people are attacking him, saying he's a Muslim, assuming that that's going to hurt him in the polls, the reaction will be to sort of like just deny it. I don't blame the campaign at all. I think the campaign and Barack Obama are fantastic. But, you know, there's no doubt that in the campaign is not... is there to try to win an election, and they don't need people adding to the confusion. And so I think that there were some, not Obama, but some who thought that it would be more beneficial just to sort of make sure that it never became an issue at all. And so I think that's sort of like what we saw coming from the campaign.
Yet when he was challenged on his association with the Reverend Wright, he made a speech in Philadelphia about race that many pointed to as a turning point in the campaign. He used it as a teachable moment.
Yeah.
Could this also not have been a teachable moment?
Well, I mean, I thought it was a teachable moment when General Powell made it very clear that any 7-year-old kid, American kid who happens to be Muslim, should aspire to be president one day. And he also pointed out that there was a 20-year-old young man who was Muslim who gave his life up in defense of his country, an American young man who died in Iraq. And so that was, I think, a transformative moment in American politics. And by the way, Barack Obama has said that there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. He has said that they're commended Muslim Americans on Larry King Live. Specifically, he did that on national television.
In an appearance in September, September 8th on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, he was asked about the rumors that he is a Muslim and did not reply with a forceful statement, let's put it that way.
You're absolutely right that John McCain has not talked about my Muslim faith, and you're absolutely right that that has not
Christian
come...
My
Christian faith. And, well, what I'm saying is he hasn't suggested that I'm a Muslim. And I think that his campaign upper echelons have not either. What I think is fair to say is that coming out of the Republican camp, there have been efforts to suggest that perhaps I'm not who I say I am when it comes to my faith, something which I find deeply offensive and that has been going on for a pretty long time.
And Congressman Ellison, if you compare that response with Colin Powell's on Meet the Press 2 weeks ago, it sounds very defensive.
Well, I would say this, I'm a strong Obama supporter. I'm not going to get on National Public Radio and in any way take away from my candidate. I'm very proud to be a supporter of Barack Obama. But I will say that I thought that General Powell's comments were transformative and transcendent, and I was extremely proud of him when he made those remarks. And he just showed that he's a great statesman.
And let me ask you another question, and this has to do with your experience as a candidate, both when you were first elected and subsequently. What is it like to run for an office like the House of Representatives, a very important job, as a Muslim in America?
Well, it's a lot less interesting than people might think. I mean, the fact is my district is overwhelmingly Christian, overwhelmingly people of European descent, the main thing people wanted to know from me is, what am I going to do to help get America out of the Iraq war? What about universal health care? I was dealing with those kind of issues most of the time. And by the way, it wasn't any surprise. I mean, the first time I was elected, people knew I was a Muslim. I was a member of a mosque. It was widely regarded as such. So, in Minnesota, people don't think that I'm the Muslim congressman. They think I'm just their congressman. If you understand what I'm saying.
I do understand what you're saying, and that is the way, as General Powell would have put it, we are supposed to do it in America.
Yeah, well, I mean, I tell you, when it became clear that I had a real chance to be elected to the United States Congress and my race started to get more national attention, that's when the Muslim thing really, really kicked into high gear. Minnesotans really were like, oh, yeah, we know that. He's, I'm Lutheran, I'm Catholic, I'm Jewish, so what? But when my candidacy hit national news, that's when the whole issue of religion really became much more prominent. And quite frankly, it took me about several weeks to understand why it was such a big deal for people. But whenever you're the first of something, that's a big thing. And of course, we are only a few years hence 9/11, so that also added to a certain measure of drama, I guess. But I'll tell you this, I don't think that the number of people who believe that Barack Obama is Muslim is enough to have any bearing on this election. I don't think that it's wise for anyone to think that it's somehow being associated or affiliated with the Muslim community is politically radioactive, because I think Americans are by and large fair-minded people and do not hold to religiously bigoted ideas. I think that anyone who thinks that they need to be aware of the Muslim thing is catering to probably less than 3 or 4% or less than 1% of the electorate, and these folks are very unlikely to be Democratic voters anyway. It's not like you're losing anything.
Let's get some callers into the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We want to hear from Arab Americans and Muslim Americans today. Let's go to Ayat. Ayat is with us from West Bloomfield in Michigan.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, in general, I understand why Senator Obama or Senator McCain have kept their distance from Muslims. I realize that there is a lot of just controversy around Islam and maybe misunderstanding amongst Americans. But I think what really is most shocking sometimes is just reading some of the so-called experts online, whether it's, through, sites like Jihad Watch or, DVD that's been passed around, Obsession, in swing states. It's just really shocking to see that that's the perception that people have about Islam and Muslims. So I think more upsetting than anything else is just, people that are posting these things and making claims about Islam that really are untrue. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, just very quickly, Ayat, do you think it's better that these comments are subterranean, or that in the context of an election they're brought out and out into the open?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that they're brought out even more, and, and again, I go back to Obsession and how it's been just distributed during this election, it's just very shocking and upsetting. And I think that's the biggest challenge that Muslim Americans find, and not necessarily, the way that presidential candidates have associated themselves with Muslims.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Well, if I could comment, I think that Ayat has a point. some of these images have been extremely disturbing and offensive, and it's difficult for Muslim parents to explain it to their kids. But I just want to say that the overwhelming number of Americans do not subscribe to this kind of stuff. This is a highly motivated, very vocal, very small number of people. And it's important to keep that as a matter of perspective.
Joining us now is Firas Ahmad, an essayist living in Boston. In February, he wrote a piece for Islamica magazine called The American Muslim Community's Obama Problem. You can find a link to it on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. He's with us from WGBH, our member station in Boston. And Firas Ahmad, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks very much, Neil. Nice to be here.
And hey there, Firas.
Hi, Congressman Ellison. How are you?
And I wanted to ask you, we just have a minute or so before the break, but your thesis in brief is that in part Muslim Americans and Arab Americans have not provided the political space for this conversation to go on.
Yeah, I kind of took a step back from where the conversation was going and tried to look at not what Obama was not doing for the Muslim community, but what the Muslim community may not be doing as good a job of for Obama, and in that sense, creating the opportunity for him to support them as opposed to constantly concerned about how he is being perceived or how he's negatively being perceived as a Muslim. So the fundamental argument was the key is to expand the range of political options that he might have, and that must be done not necessarily in the political realm, but maybe outside the political realm as well. So we're talking about media, and we're talking about perceptions. And as any politician, Obama is constrained by what people perceive to be true. And given just what the caller mentioned about the Obsession DVD and kind of the images being portrayed about Muslims in the country today, people, while I agree with Congressman Ellison wholeheartedly, I think generally Americans are fair-minded people. But when you see these images over and over and over again, they tend to impact how you perceive people. And so if Muslims were capable of changing that perception or empowered themselves to change it, they would go a long way in terms of changing the way people like Obama or other politicians can interact with them.
We'll continue to explore ways that might happen and also ask our listeners, as Arab Americans or Muslim Americans, what has it been like to experience this presidential campaign this year? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. We'll continue in just a moment. Stay with us. I'm Neil Cownan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Cownan in Washington. Polls tell us that Muslim Americans are twice as likely to be independents compared with other voters. Those same polls tell us most Muslim voters are expected to support Barack Obama. But the story is more complicated. Many Muslim Americans are frustrated by this campaign. They argue they've been ignored by both candidates and vilified. They worry that Muslim and Arab are being equated with terrorists. If you're a Muslim American or Arab American, how has this campaign played out for you? 800-989-8255 is our phone number. The email address, talk@npr.org. You can also share your story on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Our guests are Representative Keith Ellison, a Democratic congressman from Minnesota, the first Muslim American to be elected to the Congress in the United States, and Firas Ahmad, who wrote the Muslim American Community's Obama Problem in February's Islamica magazine. And I wanted you, Firas Ahmad, if you would, just expand on what you were talking about just before the break in terms of the responsibility, as you describe it, of the Muslim American and Arab American communities to erect structures, institutions that can help incorporate them into the mainstream of America.
Yeah, I mean, I would maybe talk about an example maybe from another community that might be instructive or a way of understanding this issue that I'm trying to bring up. Obama himself is not just doesn't have just a Muslim background in the sense that his father was Muslim, but he also is, of course, African-American. But we don't see any attacks against him from conservative groups or the right wing about his African-American-ness. We see them coming about his Muslim background, and that's because it's certainly unthinkable in the world today, or at least in America today, to attack someone, a candidate, based on their African-American background. And in fact, only recently we saw Don Imus lose his job very quickly over a radio show where he made some comments, untoward comments towards African-Americans. Now, that's not just because people are not racist against African Americans, because certainly there is some racism in America. But at the same time, African American community over the years and over many centuries have developed a number of institutions, including things like the NAACP, but also, you know, popular perceptions of African Americans like the Cosby Show and other kinds of institutions that have made it very difficult for kind of public racist remarks to be made openly. And in the case of Muslims who have been here for now almost 30, 40 years, and if you consider the African-American community to be 30% of the Muslim community, they've been here for years beyond that. And we still don't have some of those basic institutions. So I would refer to an editorial that came out in the New York Times several weeks ago by Edward Luttwak, where he said that, he made the argument that according to Sharia, Muslims in the world must conspire to assassinate Barack Obama if he's elected, which is a completely erroneous, false argument that has no basis in fact. The fact that that article could get published in the paper of record in America, which is the New York Times, means that there's nobody in these circles of influence and understanding, say the New York Times editorial board, that have any understanding of what it means to be a Muslim in America. And that needs to change before.
Just let me add. Of course, it was on the opposite editorial. It was an op-ed. It wasn't an editorial. But go ahead. Congressman Ellison.
I have to very, very respectfully recommend that my friend check out a version of This American Life that Ira Glass put on, where it focused on African American white union members who were not voting for Obama because of him being black, and were pretty explicit about it and the struggle that they've had, particularly in certain parts of Pennsylvania. It's a very penetrating, interesting story. And I think that while I wish that the African American community had pretty much wiped away racial insensitivity and intolerance, it's just still very much an uphill battle. But I also want to also say that, look, I'm not the only African American in Congress. I'm not the only Muslim in Congress. So is Andre Carson, a Muslim, second one elected. There are four African American women. Four Muslim women running for state representative across the nation, and two of them are absolutely scheduled to win. There are, the Muslim community in America is a building political force, is focused on civic engagement, is working hard to get a message out, and when I think of things like obsession, this is not a failure on behalf of the Muslim community to get a message out. This is people who are actively trying to defame an entire community. So I guess the premise is a little bit strained to me to say that somehow the failure is on the Muslim community to not communicate. That's not where the responsibility is primarily. Primarily, it's on people who are engaging in Islamophobia. And it's incumbent upon people within the Muslim community, Christian community, Jewish community, other people of faith who are people of goodwill, to continue to build upon this historical tolerance and religious tolerance that America has had. Again, let's not forget, the First Amendment to the Constitution establishes religious freedom and tolerance for all faiths. But I guess I just have to say that because I think it's important to keep the record as clear as possible.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Layla. Layla with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, hi. I wanted to talk from experience. I've been helping here in Charlotte with the Obama campaign, but in the background. I didn't want to be in the front lines because I'm wearing hijab at the same time. Working, I didn't even want to put my Obama sticker on my car because of all the, people are so ignorant and I didn't want to actually make it even worse on Obama. Just wanted to help in the sidelines, taking people to polls helping with conversing in the, actually taking people conversing. I didn't converse myself.
Because you thought it would be counterproductive?
I think so. Because of all the ignorance around, people have been, and the hatred and intolerance, people have been getting their information from so-called experts. But, usually the experts are people who study Islam and study Muslims. And these are people in universities, people who Middle Eastern studies, professors, but I don't see those people on TV anymore. They used to, get their opinions and stuff, but not anymore. So I wish people would take their information about Islam and Muslims from the right sources.
Congressman Ellison, I wonder if you have anything to say to Layla.
Well, Layla, I wish you could be fully out there with your advocacy of our great candidate, but I want to thank you for the work that you are doing, and I think your work's going to pay off, inshallah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Layla, thank you very much for the phone call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Back in June, Andrea Elliott, a reporter for the New York Times, wrote about the relationship between Muslim voters and the Obama campaign. You can find a link to her piece on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And Andrea Elliott joins us today from the studios of Audio Ruckus in Minneapolis. And nice to have you on the program again.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us a little bit about this voting bloc. If the candidates are ignoring it, do they do so at their peril?
Well, it's interesting. I've actually heard a lot of stories like Layla's, the caller who just spoke. There is a kind of contradictory phenomenon at work here, I would say. On the one hand, there are all of these signs of a Muslim political awakening in this country. Muslims are running for public office. Muslim organizations are mobilizing people to register to vote, organizing to get them to the polls. This is a community that is trying more than ever to not only reclaim its image in the media, but claim a place in American society through the political system. And at the same time, just as they are becoming more politically engaged, they're finding their faith the object of a lot of negative attention in this campaign. They've really become kind of political liability. It's so much the case that the joke among some Muslim activists I've spoken with is that they should endorse the candidate they don't want to win. But it should be said that you see this arm's length attitude towards Muslims coming from both parties. You've given some examples from the Obama side. I would also call attention to the McCain side of this. You have supporters of McCain continuing on talk radio and rallies to play off of the rumors of the false rumors of Obama's being a Muslim by using his middle name. And Senator McCain has tried to distance himself sometimes from this approach, apologizing, but even in his attempt to shoot down these comments, there have been some interesting moments. There was the town hall meeting in a suburb of Minneapolis this month when a woman told McCain she couldn't trust Obama because he was an Arab. And McCain's response was, "No, ma'am, he's a decent family man citizen." So he's setting the record straight by saying he's not an Arab, but one could also interpret his comment to be kind of drawing a distinction between Arab and citizen. And that's the kind of dichotomy that has been out there as this campaign has unfolded on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Sarah in Houston, Texas. "I'm not Arab or Muslim, but my husband grew up in Lebanon and is a non-practicing Muslim. We find the negative connotation attached to being Arab or Muslim infuriating. There are many fine citizens in our community who just happen to be Arab or Muslim. They own businesses. They are productive citizens who contribute to the economy. They vote and they participate in their communities. And on 9/11, we're just as horrified as the rest of us. We are disgusted with the fact that Arabs and Muslims are being treated as second-class citizens in this presidential campaign." And I wonder, Andrea Elliott, do you think that's a widespread opinion?
I do think it's widespread. It should be said that this is, at the same time, not a vote that I think either party is taking for granted or is utterly dismissing. There are an estimated 700,000 registered Muslim voters in key battleground states. That figure comes from Muslim political organizations that have been compiling databases of registered voters based on phone banking and name matching. This has been going on for years. And so they have numbers like 136,000 in Ohio, 122,000 in Pennsylvania, 72,000 in Virginia. The consensus would be that those numbers are high enough to tilt a close race in any of those places. So I think that there is an acknowledgement that this is an electorate that matters, but it's also been kept at a distance.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. Let's go to Ashkan. Ashkan with us from Tuscaloosa in Alabama.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say that, first of all, thank you for bringing this up, because it's something that's been present since the election, or since Obama first won the primary. But I'm a non-practicing Muslim. I'm not even Arab. I'm actually of Persian descent. And I actually served in Iraq. I served in the military right after high school. And, I find it very insulting that people will say things like, "Well, his name is Barack Muhammad Obama." And I tell people, "No, you're wrong. I don't know what email you read that off of, but his actual middle name is Hussein." And that doesn't necessarily mean that he's a Muslim. And even if he were, why is that a bad thing? I had a friend who asked me the other day, well, do you think that if the president of the United States should be required to be a Christian? And I said, well, why would you think that? You know, of course not. I'm a Muslim. But he said that he thought that because this country was founded on Judeo-Christian values, that you needed a president who had Christian values. And my response to that is, well, I think that you get Christian values confused with values in general, because Muslims, Christians, Jews, any faith, any God-fearing faith, all have the same value systems. We all value life and family and, you know, country and all that. And I joined the military to serve this country because I was so appreciative of the opportunities that I had to be an American. So it's really insulting and discouraging when you hear people say the things that they say about Muslims, especially when most of them have absolutely no understanding of the Muslim faith or the people who have share that faith.
Ash Khan, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Neil, can I make a quick point here?
I'm sorry. I just want to say this. It would be unconstitutional to require that any officer for elective, any candidate for elective office, be of a certain faith. It's in the Constitution. There can be no religious test.
And you were trying to get in for us? I'm sorry?
Yeah. I just wanted to make a point. The caller made an interesting point about Judeo-Christian values. What that is a narrative that was created even 50, 60 years ago to create space for the Jewish community to be perceived as more American. There was no Judeo-Christian term 150 years ago in America. So what happened was the Jewish community was the recipient of criticism and stereotypes and racism in the 20th century, and they created a narrative of the Judeo-Christian faith. Muslims, my point was not necessarily to say that the blame of this criticism is on Muslims. I don't think that's true. I think what is true is that it's up to Muslims to create a new narrative that includes the Islamic faith in the Judeo-Christian family. So it actually is. It's an Abrahamic religion. They share many of the same prophets. So that's not a hard story to tell. It's a question of who do you have telling that story. And my criticism to the Muslim community, at least, and those who are listening now, is that if I'm a 15-year-old kid and I want to go to journalism school or film school and I want a scholarship, there's nothing for me in my community. Nobody has anything for me to do that. They want me to become a doctor or a lawyer because those are the professions that, you know, tend to be promoted within Muslim ranks these days. So my challenge to the Muslim community really is what it is make this story an American story. And to do so, you have to empower your children to be able to tell it. And when that happens, you'll see all these problems related to the criticism and the stereotyping of Muslims somewhat dissolve. It's never going to completely go away. And I take Congressman Ellison's point about the African-American community. Of course, there's still problems.
Ash Khan, again, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're talking about Muslim and Arab Americans and this election. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We just have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask you if this is a teachable moment. What is it that we might want to take away from it? Andrea Elliott, what do you think?
What part of this teachable moment? The whole
The campaign, election. The election.
Well, I think what I've understood from within the Muslim community is that there is it's kind of been a test of sorts, in the sense that I think a lot of Muslim political activists I've talked to are fearful that Muslims are going to sit this out as a result of feeling just kind of dismissed. And yet there's an interesting generational divide on that issue of in particular, Senator Obama's handling of the Muslim community, because while older voters tend to be, I think, more easily dispirited by this, younger Muslims I've spoken to who have really been energized by this campaign in particular, like other young people in this country, have taken a more forgiving approach. And I think that just reflects the extent to which they're more assimilated.
And I'm sorry to cut you off, but I wanted to give Keith Ellison 30 seconds at least to wrap up what this teachable moment might be to him. Congressman? I think Congressman Ellison has left us. Then let's turn to you, Faraz Ahmad.
I generally think that, like the caller had said, there's a story or there's a narrative generally about where Muslims fit into this country. And I think the teachable moment is not only for the Muslim community, but the community and the larger American community to understand that there is a religion called Islam and a people called Muslims that live in America, and that they can be part of a larger story. And the question is, helping them tell that story and empowering them to tell that story. And I think that's where the key to a lot of the problems are that are emanating from this election campaign.
Faraz Ahmad joined us from WGBH, our member station in Boston. You can find a link to his piece, The American Muslim Community's Obama Problem, on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. There you can find Andrea Elliott's piece for The New York Times as well. We thank both of them for their time today, along with Congressman Keith Ellison, who joined us from Minneapolis. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As the presidential election approaches, we've asked four people to make the case for the two major party presidential candidates on foreign and domestic policy. Yesterday, we heard from Michael Gerson, who made the conservative case for Senator John McCain. In a moment, John McWhorter will join us to tell us why he supports Senator Barack Obama. Later this week, we'll hear pitches from two candidates on foreign policy, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Sarah Sewell tomorrow for Barack Obama, and former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger on Thursday for John McCain. So, Obama supporters, make the case for your candidate on domestic policy, your final argument. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can post your final argument on our blog as well. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Linguist and writer John McWhorter is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He joins us now from our bureau in New York, and nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And you're generally known as conservative in political circles. So why do you support Barack Obama?
Well, for one thing, I think I'm much more of a moderate, but I support Barack Obama for two reasons. One of them is that he is somebody who can think, and after the past 8 years, I think that this country could use a president who's actually reflective and likes to think. And in particular, Barack Obama is good at splitting the difference and looking at both sides and trying to come up with a combination. And I suppose that reminds me of myself, and it appeals to me. And so I think that he is the better man because the qualities that I just described don't happen to correspond as well to John McCain, although I have nothing against him. And then the second reason is that I honestly believe that if there were a black man in the White House with his black family, especially for 8 years, then I think it would show that even though racism is not dead in America, and even though I don't think racism will ever be completely dead in America, that something really important has happened. I think that with Barack Obama in the White House, anyone who wants to say that America is founded upon racism and America is still all about racism and that any impression otherwise is just a matter of not being able to see beyond the superficial will be pulled down to earth somewhat. It won't eliminate that kind of rhetoric, but I think that Barack Obama's presence would make people have to reconsider that maybe Martin Luther King did not die in vain and that maybe we actually have made some genuine and striking progress. And I especially think that whatever we grown-ups think, that if there were a generation of people, and this is black, white, yellow, and everything else, who grew up seeing not just Barack Obama, but the Obamas in the White House, if we saw those two girls grow up in the White House, if we saw Barack and Michelle together there every single day, on your laptop, on TV, getting in and out of Air Force One, anybody who grew up with that as a norm would be highly unlikely to, when they were adults, think of America as a country founded upon racism. They would think of America as a country that's come a long way since the 1960s. And I think that we would have a more productive dialogue about what to do about the problems that we really do have. And so it's not that I don't think that there's racism in America. It's not that I don't understand that the playing field isn't level. But I think that in 2008, we've gotten to a point where when people's primary response to that is to say we need to get rid of racism, I'm not sure what the point is, because there's no group that has required the playing field to be completely level in order to achieve. And I think for all sorts of reasons that I don't have time to go into here, that's not what the main problem is now. It's not that racism isn't a problem, but it's no longer the main issue. And the sense that the good-thinking person is supposed to look towards racism first when we talk about what poor black people's problems are, for example, is something that ends up holding people back. Because what I'm interested in, what the Manhattan Institute is interested in, is solutions. What makes people's lives better? What actually has results? And these days, talking about how we have to change the way all white people feel, or talking about how we have to wait until the playing field is perfectly level, I don't think it helps anybody. And I'd like to pull the general dialogue away from that. That is a kind of dialogue that I think people who grew up watching Barack Obama as president would be uniquely poised to have. So those are the reasons that I suspect that a week from now, give or take a few hours, I am going to be a very, very happy man.
In a column in 2006, you wrote, "Let's imagine a white guy with all of Mr. Obama's pluses. I do not think that man would be touted a year and change into his Senate appointment as a presidential possibility." Do you believe on the experience issue that Barack Obama is ready to be president of the United States?
He is, and what I said in 2006 is true now. Frankly, if he were not black, he would not be where he is. We are at a magic time where his being black helps, and that's a wonderful thing. I have no problem with it. But in 2006, before anybody had any idea we were going to get to this point, that was just something I pointed out. But as far as experience, to be perfectly frank, I thought Hillary Clinton had more experience. That now, the gradient was not large enough, I think, to matter, and I was for Barack Obama during the primaries, too. But he is intelligent enough, and he is quick enough a study that whatever experience gap he has compared to, for example, Senator McCain, he could easily make up for. And when we're talking about differences in experience that are relatively minor in this case, where there's a lot of learning that could be done very quickly, I think that there are other issues. There are issues of charisma and symbolism. There are issues of where someone falls politically and in terms of what works. And in terms of what I'm for, whatever my general reputation is, Barack Obama fits in with me much better than Senator McCain.
Let's get a caller on the conversation. Now we're talking about final arguments for Senator Barack Obama on domestic issues today. Let's talk with Tom. Tom is with us from Chillicothe in Ohio.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go ahead, Tom.
I wanted to mention that the domestic program that I really like is his effort to recruit new teachers by exchanging scholarship and or, you know, help with tuition in exchange for 4 years of service in schools that are kind of struggling, schools that might be in areas where they might not necessarily have as much opportunity as, you know, the rest of the schools. I just think that that'll really diversify those that go into teaching. And even if they don't necessarily stay in after 4 years, I think that it'll definitely help the rest of the teachers, those of us who are in it for the career, to gain a little bit of, understanding and sympathy from the rest of the public.
Perhaps an elevated status.
Yes.
John McWhorter, what do you think?
I think that's definitely true, and it plays into a general phenomenon with Obama, which is that, again, I think that he's interested in things that would work rather than the same old patterns. He has actually spoken before a teachers union heavy crowd and been booed for a couple of the things that he said, and it's because the school question is very, very complex. But anybody who thinks it's just a matter of poor schools don't get enough money from on high is understandably so, but mistaken. That's not what the problem is, and Barack Obama understands that. And so I think that he would be poised to make a difference. He also realizes that No Child Left Behind, despite its good intentions, needs to be either deeply revised or scrapped, and that's something that's important. He also cares about education to an extent that John McCain simply constitutionally does not. So, once again, I think that he's a better person for this moment.
Tom, thanks for the call. Appreciate
it. Thank you very, very much.
Let me ask you, John McWhorter, if Barack Obama is elected president next week, a week from today, he will be working with a Democratic-controlled House and Senate as well. How do you think he's going to be able to cope with these very experienced inside politicians who are going to have agendas of their own, agendas that may not comport necessarily with his agenda, who may want to enact programs of their own?
Well, you know, Neil, it seems to me that what you've just described is what it is to be a president of the United States. And so the question is, how would Barack Obama deal with it? I think that he would deal with it pretty well, given that he is someone who I think, talk about what someone is constitutionally inclined towards trying to bring the best of both sides together into something constructive. And so, of course, he will be presented with differing agendas, and he'll do his best. It's interesting. People seem to look at his voting record in the Senate and suppose that he's actually under the impression that that's the kind of presidency that he would put forward.
A highly liberal voting record.
Yeah, and he isn't. I mean, nobody could realistically think that in this country, which is basically a center-right country, that that would be possible, even with the Democratic majority. That's just not what even Democrats are about. And so what he's going to do is run the country in a way that works well for him, but is also all about compromise, because that's what it is to run a government. I think he'll do just fine.
Jeff is on the line. Jeff calling us from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Hi. I just wanted to propose my final argument as to why he should be and is the most viable candidate. And I believe he is the most viable candidate for sort of the rewelding of our fine melting pot in this country back together, reaching across all barriers from seniors to young people, across races, across religions, whether he's negotiating with Canada and Mexico and NAFTA, or whether he's negotiating accords in the Middle East. He has this sort of come let us reason together empirical attitude that lends itself to listening to others, reasoning with others, and I can't see the angry John McCain in that role. I've never been able to fit him in that role.
Well, let's focus on Barack Obama for just a moment. And just to pick up your metaphor, Jeff, in the cauldron of the presidential campaign, Barack Obama, as we just heard in the previous segment, has generally declined to embrace Muslim Americans and Arab Americans and has pretty much avoided the issue of immigration.
I believe the first thing he has to do is run for office, and overcoming fear in a campaign is not in a way that you can directly, you know, answer that question. I think it can be answered and will be answered once he becomes president, however.
John McWhorter?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, I think we have to understand. People are often surprised to find out that Obama is a politician. There's a kind of a Jesus air that people seem to put around him. And, yeah, obviously, he has to avoid having Muslims appear with him. He has to avoid talking about those issues because, for reasons that all of us are dismayed about, as we heard in the past segment, there are people out there where their vote might tip one way or another based on whether or not they associate him with Islam. And that's not a good thing. But just because it's not a good thing doesn't mean that it isn't true. And so, yeah, let's wait to see what happens when he gets into office. It's interesting. There are certain things that will always be with us. Like, for example, once he gets in, yeah, there will be people on bar stools saying, well, now that the blacks have a president, what more do they want? There will be those people. There will, roughly every 6 weeks, be discovered a plot by a bunch of idiots where they are pretending to have a plan to assassinate the president. There will be those things. But I think that there will be so many good things about Barack Obama in office, including race-relevant legislation, such as bringing fathers back into contact with their children, such as prisoner reentry programs. These are really important things, faith-based and non-faith-based. I think it'll be a wonderful time, although it will not be utopia because we'll never have utopia.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. We're talking about final arguments for the candidates. Yesterday, we heard Michael Gerson make the conservative case for John McCain on domestic policy. Today, we're listening to John McWhorter of the Manhattan Institute make the same case for Barack Obama. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Gordon. Gordon with us from Elk Rapids in Michigan.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm a disabled veteran, and when Barack was first elected, I was watching the Veterans Committee reports for a new budget, and they were just trying to pass through the regular budget and make cuts in the VA. And Barack, they put him, he was on the Veterans Affairs Committee. And Barack said that you can't do that. We're fighting wars on two different fronts. There's veterans that are going to need hospitalization and mental health. And he was able to actually add money to the budget that year. And I thought, well, this man is really has his priorities correct. I'd work for him.
Gordon, a lot of veterans would say he's a man without military experience who declined to don the uniform.
That has little to do with being president of the United States. What has more importance is whether he cares about veterans and their actual welfare.
John McWhorter?
Yeah, and one of the most interesting things about the debates was to see that Barack Obama, as far as the notion that the Democrats are soft on defense, actually almost seemed hawkish in terms of his stance on Pakistan in comparison to John McCain. It's been an interesting campaign in that that is one thing that we have not been able to see lobbed at Barack Obama, that he somehow doesn't understand that a country has to defend itself. And the anti-Americanism that he's been accused of, it's quite clear to any thinking person how hollow that kind of rhetoric is when it applies to him. And I did want to touch on one other thing about him bringing the country together. Certainly on the international scene, there will be value to us having somebody, especially somebody with Hussein as a middle name, as our chief representative. Here in this country, I don't think we want to get too rosy about everybody all of a sudden melting and realizing the commonality of all humanity once he's in office. But I think that definitely with younger people, there will be that. The president will be black and it won't mean anything to them. And to them, the idea that there was a time, especially a recent time, when people were walking around saying, oh, there could never be a black president, will seem historical and peculiar. It'll be like, you know, it'll be like flash cubes are to me at the age of 43. And so that's something to look for. It'll be the future America that he will help bring together more than the America that's already set up. But still, I look forward to that.
I could never make those flash cubes work. Gordon, thanks. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. And let me finally ask you, a lot of people very concerned about the economic situation in this country right now, and not just in this country, but around the world, John McWhorter. What do you think of Barack Obama's approach to solving this problem? Again, it's not something the president does alone, but in a way, it's almost more of the role of the president as chief of state, as well as president as chief of government.
To the extent that he's interested in rolling up his sleeves and making sure that individual members of the American public are hurt by this mess as little as possible, to the extent that that seems to be where his heart really is, as opposed to his heart really being in trying to make things as easy as possible for the people who created the situation, I think that this is what we need. There are a lot of inexact sciences being dealt with in terms of how we get out of that crisis. And I think that, once again, he's the right person because he's interested in making sure that this isn't like, for example, what happened with the savings and loan scandal, where basically America took a bath. So he's trying to learn from the past rather than repeating it. And I've admired him for that.
John McWhorter, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
John McWhorter, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, with us today from our bureau in New York City. His most recent book is All About the Beat, Why Hip-Hop Can't Save Black America. Tomorrow, Sarah Sewell joins us to make the case for Barack Obama based on his foreign policy agenda. Then on Thursday, former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger will argue on behalf of his favorite for the President of the United States, John McCain. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.